Jessica had been caught by this utterance, but had managed, "Your father might have said that." Alito, throwing a handful of sand into the air to watch it fall, "Yes, he might have, but my father did not consider then how quickly water makes everything fall back to the ground from which it came." Now, standing beside Ganima in the siege, Jessica felt the shock of those words anew. She turned, glanced back at the still-flowing throng, let her gaze wander across Stilgar's shadowy shape in the alcove. Stilgar was no tame Fremen, trained only to carry twigs to the nest. He was still a hawk. When he thought of the color red, he did not think of flowers, but of blood.
"You're so quiet suddenly," Ganima said. "Is something wrong?"
Jessica shook her head.
"It's something Leto said this morning, that's all. When you went out to the plantings? What did he say?"
Jessica thought of the curious look of adult wisdom which had come over Leto's face out there in the morning. It was the same look which came over Ganima's face right now.
"He was recalling the time when Gurney came back from the smugglers to the Atreides banner," Jessica said. "Then you were talking about Stilgar," Ganima said.
Jessica did not question how this insight occurred. The twins appeared capable of reproducing each other's thought trains at will.
"Yes, we were," Jessica said. "Stilgar didn't like to hear Gurney calling Paul his duke, but Gurney's presence forced this upon all of the Fremen. Gurney kept saying, 'My duke.'"
"I see," Ganima said. "And, of course, Leto observed that he was not yet Stilgar's duke."
"That's right."
"You know what he was doing to you, of course," Ganima said.
"I'm not sure I do," Jessica admitted,
and she found this admission particularly disturbing, because it had not occurred to her that Leto was doing anything at all to her.
"He was trying to ignite your memories of our father," Ganima said. "Leto's always hungry to know our father from the viewpoints of others who knew him."
"But doesn't Leto have—"
"Oh, he can listen to the inner life, certainly, but that's not the same. You spoke about him, of course. Our father, I mean. You spoke of him as your son."
"Yes."
Jessica clipped it off. She did not like the feeling that these twins could turn her on and off at will, open her memories for observation, touch any emotion which attracted their interest. Ganima might be doing that right now.
"Leto said something to disturb you," Ganima said.
Jessica found herself shocked at the necessity to suppress anger.
"Yes, he did."
"You don't like the fact that he knows our father as our mother knew him, and knows our mother as our father knew her," Ganima said. "You don't like what that implies, what we may know about you."
"I'd never really thought about it that way before," Jessica said, finding her voice stiff.
"It's the knowledge of sensual things which usually disturbs," Ganima said. "It's your conditioning. You find it extremely difficult to think of us as anything but children. But there's nothing our parents did together, in public or in private, that we would not know."
For a brief instant, Jessica found herself returning to the reaction which had come over her out there beside the Khanat. But now she focused that reaction upon Ganima.
"He probably spoke of your duke's rutting sensuality," Ganima said. "Sometimes Leto needs a bridle on his mouth."
"Is there nothing these twins cannot profane?" Jessica wondered, moving from shock to outrage to revulsion.
How dared they speak of her, Leto's sensuality? Of course a man and woman who loved each other would share the pleasure of their bodies. It was a private and beautiful thing, not to be paraded in casual conversation between a child and an adult.
"Child and adult!"
Abruptly, Jessica realized that neither Leto nor Ganima had done this casually. As Jessica remained silent, Ganima said,
"We've shocked you. I apologize for both of us. Knowing Leto, I know he didn't consider apologizing. Sometimes when he's following a particular scent, he forgets how different we are from you, for instance."
Jessica thought,
"And that is why you both do this, of course. You are teaching me."
And she wondered then,
"Who else are you teaching? Stilgar? Duncan?"
"Leto tries to see things as you see them," Ganima said. "Memories are not enough. When you try the hardest, just then, you most often fail."
Jessica sighed. Ganima touched her grandmother's arm.
"Your son left many things unsaid, which yet must be said, even to you. Forgive us, but he loved you. Don't you know that?"
Jessica turned away to hide the tears glistening in her eyes.
"He knew your fears," Ganima said, "just as he knew Stilgar's fears. Dear Still, our father was his doctor of beasts, and still was no more than the green snail hidden in its shell. She hummed the tune from which she'd taken these words. The music hurled the lyrics against Jessica's awareness without compromise. Oh, doctor of beasts, to a green snail shell, with its timid miracle hidden, awaiting death, you come as a deity. Even snails know that gods obliterate, and cures bring pain, that heaven is seen through a door of flame. Oh, doctor of beasts, I am the man-snail, who sees your single eye peering into my shell. Why, Muad'Dib, why?
Ghanima said, Unfortunately, our father left many man-snails in our universe.
The assumption that humans exist within an essentially impermanent universe, taken as an operational precept, demands that the intellect become a totally aware balancing instrument. But the intellect cannot react thus without involving the entire organism. Such an organism may be recognized by its burning, driving behavior. And thus it is with a society treated as organism. But here we encounter an old inertia. Societies move to the goading of ancient reactive impulses. They demand permanence. Any attempt to display the universe of impermanence arouses rejection patterns, fear, anger, and despair. Then how do we explain the acceptance of prescience? Simply, the giver of prescient visions, because he speaks of an absolute, permanent realization, may be greeted with joy by humankind, even while predicting the most dire events. The Book of Leto, after Hark al-Ada.
It's like fighting in the dark, Alia said.
She paced the council chamber in angry strides, moving from the tall silvery draperies which softened the morning sun at the eastern windows to the divans grouped beneath decorated wall panels at the room's opposite end. Her sandals crossed spice-fiber rugs, parquet wood, tiles of giant garnet, and once more, rugs. At last she stood over Irulan and Idaho, who sat facing each other on divans of gray whale fur. Idaho had resisted returning from Tabor, but she had sent peremptory orders. The abduction of Jessica was more important than ever now, but it had to wait. Idaho's mentat perceptions were required.
These things are cut from the same pattern, Alia said. They stink of a far-reaching plot.
Perhaps not, Irulan ventured, but she glanced questioningly at Idaho. Alia's face lapsed into an undisguised sneer. How could Irulan be that innocent? Unless... Alia bent a sharp and questioning stare onto the princess. Irulan wore a simple black abba robe, which matched the shadows in her spice indigo eyes. Her blonde hair was tied in a tight coil at the nape of her neck, accenting a face thinned and toughened by years on Arrakis. She still retained the haughtiness she'd learned in the court of her father, Saddam IV, and Alia often felt that this prideful attitude could mask the thoughts of a conspirator. Idaho lounged in the black and green uniform of an Atreides house guard, no insignia. It was an affectation which was secretly resented by many of Alia's actual guards, especially the Amazons, who gloried in insignia of office. They did not like the plain presence of the Gola swordmaster Mentat, the more so because he was the husband of their mistress. "So the tribes want the Lady Jessica reinstated into the Regency Council," Idaho said.
"How can that they make unanimous demand?"
Alia said, pointing to an embossed sheet of spice paper on the divan beside Irulan.
"Faradin is one thing, but this has the stink of other alignments."
"What does Stilgar think?" Irulan asked.
"His signature's on that paper," Alia said.
"But if how could he deny the mother of his god?" Alia sneered.
Idaho looked up at her, thinking, "That's awfully close to the edge with Irulan." Again he wondered why Alia had brought him back here when she knew that he was needed at Siege Tabor if the abduction plot were to be carried off. Was it possible she'd heard about the message sent to him by the preacher? This thought filled his breast with turmoil. How could that mendicant mystic know the secret signal by which Paul Atreides had always summoned his swordmaster? Idaho longed to leave this pointless meeting and return to the search for an answer to that question.
"There's no doubt that the preacher has been off-planet," Alia said. "The guild wouldn't dare deceive us in such a thing. I will have him..."
"Careful," Irulan said.
"Indeed, have a care," Idaho said. "Half the planet believe him to be," he shrugged, "your brother." And Idaho hoped he had carried this off with a properly casual attitude. How had the man known that signal?
"But if he's a courier or a spy of the..."
"He's made contact with no one from Chome or House Carino," Irulan said.
"We can be sure of nothing."
Alia did not try to hide her scorn. She turned her back on Irulan, faced Idaho. He knew why he was here. Why didn't he perform as expected? He was in council because Irulan was here. The history which had brought a princess of House Carino into the Atreides' fold could never be forgotten. Allegiance, once changed, could change again. Duncan's Mentat power should be searching for flaws, for subtle deviations in Irulan's behavior. Idaho stirred, glanced at Irulan. There were times when he resented the straight-line necessities imposed on Mentat performance. He knew what Alia was thinking. Irulan would know it as well. But this princess wife to Paul Muad'Dib had overcome the decisions which had made her less than the royal concubine, Chani. There could be no doubt of Irulan's devotion to the royal twins. She had renounced family and Bene Gesserit in dedication to the Atreides.
"My mother is part of this plot," Alia insisted. "For what other reason would the sisterhood send her back here at a time such as this?"
"Hysteria isn't going to help us," Idaho said. Alia whirled away from him, as he'd known she would. It helped him that he did not have to look at that once-beloved face which was now so twisted by alien possession.
"Well," Irulan said, "the Guild can't be completely trusted for—"
"The Guild!" Alia sneered. "We can't rule out the enmity of the Guild or the Bene Gesserit," Idaho said. "But we must assign them special categories as essentially passive combatants. The Guild will live up to its basic rule, never govern. They're a parasitic growth, and they know it. They won't do anything to kill the organism which keeps them alive."
"Their idea of which organism keeps them alive may be different from ours," Irulan drawled.
It was the closest she ever came to a sneer, that lazy tone of voice which said,
"You missed a point, Mentat."
Alia appeared puzzled. She had not expected Irulan to take this tack. It was not the kind of view which a conspirator would want examined.
"No doubt," Idaho said, "but the Guild won't come out overtly against House Atreides. The Sisterhood, on the other hand, might risk a certain kind of political break, which, if they do, it'll be through a front. Someone or some group they can disavow," Irulan said. "The Bene Gesserit haven't existed all of these centuries without knowing the value of self-effacement. They prefer being behind the throne, not on it."
"Self-effacement?" Alia wondered. "Was that Irulan's choice?"
"Precisely the point I make about the Guild," Idaho said.
He found the necessities of argument and explanation helpful. They kept his mind from other problems. Alia strode back toward the sunlit windows. She knew Idaho's blind spot. Every Mentat had it. They had to make pronouncements. This brought about a tendency to depend upon absolutes, to see finite limits. They knew this about themselves. It was part of their training. Yet they continued to act beyond self-limiting parameters.
"I should have left him at Siege Tabor," Alia thought. "It would have been better to just turn Irulan over to Javid for questioning."
Within her skull, Alia heard a rumbling voice.
"Exactly."
"Shut up, shut up, shut up," she thought.
A dangerous mistake beckoned her in these moments, and she could not recognize its outlines. All she could sense was the danger. Idaho had to help her out of this predicament. He was a Mentat. Mentats were necessary. The human computer replaced the mechanical devices destroyed by the Butlerian Jihad.
"Thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind."
But Alia longed now for a compliant machine. They could not have suffered from Idaho's limitations. You could never distrust a machine. Alia heard Irulan's drawling voice.
"A faint within a faint, within a faint, within a faint," Irulan said. "We all know the accepted pattern of attack upon power. I don't blame Alia for her suspicions. Of course, she suspects everyone, even us. Ignore that for a moment, though. What remains is the prime arena of motives, the most fertile source of danger to the Regency."
"Chome," Idaho said. His voice meant tat flat. Alia allowed herself a grim smile. The Combine Onet Ober Advance Mercantiles. But House Atreides dominated Chome with 51% of its shares. The priesthood of Muad'Dib held another 5%, pragmatic acceptance by the great houses that Dune controlled the priceless mélange. Not without reason was the spice often called the secret coinage. Without mélange, the Spacing Guild's highliners could not move.